piled into the promised car, we made the final leg of the journey in silence. Once at Bennington, it was with something near regret that I eventually left them, dismayed to find that the thought of returning to my room, to Lucy, had since grown terribly dim.
Wait!
I turned and found the boy with the leather elbow patches. Tom, I reminded myself, running toward me. He leaned over, taking the suitcase from my grasp.
Let me carry it for you.
And so he walked me back to my room, made sure that I was able to get in safely, setting my suitcase beside my bed as he gazed around the space. I wondered what it was that he saw reflected there, in the hopelessly childish duvet that adorned my bed, a ghastly shade of pink and white that my aunt had purchased in a misguided attempt to welcome her new ward into an adult home, at the embarrassing effort that I had made to decorate my side of the room, various sketches tacked to the wall. He paused at the map on Lucy's side of the room, studying, or so it seemed, the numerous pins that we had once placed there. A silly game we played with some intensity our first year, when the newness of our relationship had made anything seem possible. And then he moved to the row of photographs that I had taped above my dresser. I had signed up for a design class on a lark that fall, and the instructor, a working photographer who spent a few days out of the week in Vermont and the rest in New York City, had been encouraged by several photography enthusiasts in the class to erect a makeshift darkroom on campus. My mother's old camera had been among the few things I had brought with me to Vermont, though I had never really thought to learn how to use the thing. Soon, however, I began spending hours in the darkroom, happy to lose myself in the process of developing and printing, finally feeling as though I had found something of my own at last, something separate and distinct from the Alice I was with Lucy. It was a strange experience, one that began to unfurl within the folds of my stomach, so that there were days when I felt filled up by it, as if this new knowledge of what I might be capable of was nourishment enough. I felt my heart beat faster, waiting for him to speak. But then the door opened, and Lucy rushed in.
"You're home," she breathed. "I was worried. I just checked the bus, and it said..."
She stopped then, and turned. Tom smiled, nodded his head.
"Lucy," I began, "this is Tom. He was my knight in shining armor today," I said, before relaying the whole tale for her. Anxiously, nervously, so that both of them looked slightly embarrassed, slightly aghast, by the time I had run out of breath. A frown had crept across Lucy's face at the story, and she remained silent once I had finished. We stood there, the three of us, the knowledge that something had changed, that something had shifted, coursing through the room. But then later, I wondered whether Tom had even noticed, or whether it wasn't something that Lucy and I had felt alone, another example of our strange duo that defied explanation, that defied normalcy. And one that I, for the first time, felt myself suddenly anxious to shed. Suddenly, it was no longer Lucy and I. It was both of us and Tom, too, a strange little threesome that I soon learned refused to fit together. At first, I had made a concerted effort. When I was given an assignment by my professor to learn how to use a view camera, the weight of the piece requiring more than one set of hands, I invited Lucy to join Tom and me as we hauled the equipment around campus, Tom joking he was both subject and subjected. Lucy accompanied us only the once, when we spent nearly an hour lugging it to the edge of campus to what we laughingly christened the end of the universe, the stretch of land at the entrance to Bennington, and which dipped, low and jagged, as dangerous and threatening as the end of the world, was not.
"I pity the man unfortunate enough to drive off into that,"
Tom had said, smiling back at us as he leaned against the rail, waiting for me to set up the camera and begin. Lucy had stood, tersely, staring out into the woods, and even though I had begged her to let me take her photograph as well, she had remained silent, so I wondered, in the end, whether she had heard me at all. Later, as we walked back to campus, Tom had tried to talk with her, about literature, about what she was working on in her courses.
I'm jealous you've got Professor Hyman here, he said. I would love the opportunity to take a class with him. Have you signed up for any of his yet?
She had turned to him, her gaze steely and hard.
No, but then I suppose I'd rather take a class with his better half.
Tom was silent after that. I tried to talk about it with her once, not long afterward, to try and dispel the strangeness that had stolen over us, between us. But she had only turned away, her face closed, guarded. I suspected she meant to punish me, for my relationship with Tom, a closeness that not only did not involve her, but which oftentimes left her alone. And though I felt guilty, I was confused by her odd behavior, knowing that if the situation were reversed, I would not have been so cold.
There's something not right about her, Tom said one evening, late into the spring, as we lay hidden from the commons lawn just beneath the end of the world,
waiting for the sun to begin setting.
Oh, don't be cruel, I had protested, pushing against his shoulder, protective even still of my odd roommate.
It was true that I did not condone her behavior, but I was just as embarrassed as Tom was likely offended by it. And yet I could not help but pity her, too, for those long afternoons she now spent alone, trapped in the library, for those nights we passed, silent and held apart from one another.
I'm not, he said, pulling me closer with a laugh. I promise.
He grew quiet then, and as I leaned up against him I could feel the rise and fall of him, could smell the scent that was uniquely his. Something like sun and sand, and a bit like laundry that had been left out for an afternoon. I moved closer.
It's just, he began, it's just the way she looks at you.
I frowned.
What do you mean?
When he did not respond, I turned to look up at him.
How does she look at me? I demanded.
He looked away, as if embarrassed, as if he were hesitant to say the words aloud.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to explain it.
Try,
I said, desperate to have the answer. But he only remained silent. I turned, feeling a shudder run through me. I was quiet then, pressed up against his warmth, feeling as though I would never be warm. Together, we watched the sun set in front of us. 1 month after I met Tom, things began to disappear. It was little items at first, a tube of lipstick that I couldn't locate, a necklace that went missing for a few days, only to turn up in a spot I knew I had already checked, a scarf that I could not remember wearing and that appeared in the laundry bin ready to be washed. I thought nothing of it at first, and later, when I realized it must be Lucy, I only assumed that it was how sisters lived, borrowing things from one another without asking, the mutability of their wardrobe and accessories an unwritten law between them. But then one day in early May, I walked into our room and found her standing in front of the mirror, wearing my clothes. I blinked. It wasn't simply one item, a scarf or a sweater. It was everything, from head to toe. I recognized my ivory dress with the eyelet fabric and Peter Pan collar, a smart beaded cloche that my aunt had purchased for me the previous winter. Lucy was standing, her head tilted to the side, watching herself in the mirror as she pulled at the waistline in an attempt to adjust the fit. But the dress hit strangely on her body, as if she were trying on clothes that had once been worn by her younger self. It took a few moments before her eyes met mine, before she realized that she was no longer in the room alone.
I'm sorry, she said, quickly removing the hat.
Her face had turned a deep crimson.
No, don't apologize.
I smiled, trying, and failing, I suspected, to dispel the strangeness of the moment. We had not spent much time together lately. I was either in the dark room or with Tom, and the moment seemed rendered somehow more strange, more unsettling, by our distance.
You're free to borrow it whenever you like,
I finished quickly. Despite my words, she hurried to remove the clothing. She placed the hat on my bed, looking more angry than embarrassed, I thought. The dress she lifted from her body, quickly and with such force that I worried she might tear the seams. It was all over in a matter of seconds, and once more Lucy stood before me in one of her own outfits, her face blazing with an emotion I could not quite interpret. In the end, I thought it best to ignore the incident, turning from her and taking a seat behind my desk, arranging and rearranging my books until the tension in the room settled and then passed, as if nothing had happened at all. But then, 2 weeks later, as Lucy readied herself for the morning, I found myself startled by the item she had clasped around her wrist, my mother's charm bracelet, that thin piece of once gleaming silver that had now worked itself to a tarnished grey. It was nothing valuable, of course, and yet still I counted it among my most prized possessions, a fact that Lucy well knew. I had spent hours after my mother's death studying the charms. A small couple, the girl in red, the boy in blue, preparing to ski. A bubblegum machine with tiny little coloured beads serving as the candy. A violin. I knew each and every one by heart, had memorized all their intricate details, particularly in those moments when the weight of the truth, the reality of never seeing my mother wear it again, sat heavily on my chest. As I watched it dangle from Lucy's wrist, my heart began to pound, and I saw spots in my vision, like little twinkling stars, bright lights that crowded and fought for space in front of my eyes. I blinked. I told myself that she did not mean anything by it, that surely she had just forgotten about what I had told her, about just how special the bracelet was to me. But then I paused, trying to recall. A conversation, a brief mention, anything I had said or done throughout the years we had lived together, only to find that it was all becoming too blurred, too confused in my mind. "I'd be grateful if next time you could ask." The words left my mouth and I tasted something bitter and hurried to swallow. Lucy stopped. She held a notebook in one hand, the other, the one with the bracelet, hung limply at her side. She was silent for a moment. "Ask about what, Alice?" I turned to face her, chiding myself for feeling nervous. After all, the bracelet was mine, had once belonged to my mother, and was one of the few things that I had left of her. There was nothing wrong with asking Lucy to get permission before taking it from my jewelry box, I told myself. "It's nothing, really," I said, feeling the heat as it burned my cheeks. "It's just the bracelet. I don't mind, honest, it's just, if you could ask next time." Lucy continued to peer at me with that same queer expression. Her hand had moved to the doorknob, but it froze then, as if she couldn't decide whether to respond to my request or leave the room without deigning to answer at all. Finally, she dropped her hand and said, "I don't understand." "My bracelet," I replied, stammering over the first word. I pointed to her wrist. A small laugh escaped from her then. "Alice," she said, "don't be silly." She was staring at me, her dark eyes boring into mine. I squirmed under their gaze, feeling as though I were the one who had done something wrong, as though the stolen object dangled from my wrist and not her own. "What do you mean?" I asked. Lucy held up her arm so that her wrist appeared to me sideways, a portion of the charms hidden from my sight.
"This bracelet?"
"Yes." She frowned.
"Alice, this isn't your bracelet."
I stopped. "What are you talking about, Lucy?" She dropped her arm.
"I mean that this is my bracelet."
She turned, so that her words came to me distorted by the distance.
"It was my mother's bracelet, in fact."
I opened my mouth, then shut it. I didn't know what to say. I didn't understand. I wanted to say, no, it was my mother's bracelet. And perhaps I did, though the words sounded thick and far away, as if someone other than myself was speaking. Lucy continued to stare at me with that strange look, so that I was unsure of whether she had heard me, or if, in fact, I had actually spoken the words at all. She took a step toward me.
Alice, are you feeling well? I could get the school nurse if something is wrong.
I felt a rising tide of panic, suddenly overwhelmed by it all. Her strange behavior over the last few weeks, the incident with the clothes, and now this. I wanted to shout at her, to race forward and rip the bracelet from her arm. But would they believe me? I wondered, simultaneously questioning who they even referred to. After all, who could I go to with such a problem who would not turn away laughing? It all sounded so absurd. Of course I realized that. The idea that two girls would claim the same story about a bracelet, that their respective dead mother had gifted it to them, it was so unlikely, how could it ever sound anything but absolutely ludicrous? That was what she wanted. The thought came to me quickly. It seemed absurd, hard to believe, and yet I told myself it had to be true. It had to be true for no other reason than that there was no other reason. Why else would she claim the bracelet had been a gift of her mother's if not for that outcome? She wanted to drive me mad. She knew about my past. I had told her once in those early months of friendship about the time after my parents' deaths, about the darkness and shadows that had hovered above me so that my Aunt Maud had wanted to send me away, to commit me to a place where I would never see the sun again, about how they still came, so that at times I questioned the accuracy of my mind, of my memories. I would be lying if I did not admit that for the briefest of moments it had passed my mind, that I had wondered if the bracelet did not, in fact, belong to Lucy, and I had somehow confused it as being my own, one dead mother's gift for another. But no, I told myself, looking up at her, watching her confusion with suspicion. It was mine. I knew it. I could feel my face burning, but this time it was not an embarrassment or nervousness.
"Please, Lucy," I implored.
She let out a sigh. I thought at first she meant to relent, to admit to it all, to claim it as some sort of cruel prank. But then her expression changed. Her eyes narrowed, and her face looked suddenly small and mean.
"We'll have to sort this out later, I'm afraid. I have a class now."
And with those words, she was gone. Lucy didn't return home that night. It was the first time I had slept alone in our room, and I found the sudden absence, the total quiet, to be unnerving. Shadows that I had never before noticed danced across the length of the walls. A shrill noise awoke me in the middle of the night, and it was only some time later that I realized it was simply the sound of two trees rubbing together. By then my heart had begun to pound, and I could hear a strange roaring, loud enough that it blocked out the other sounds that had frightened me only seconds before.
"Stop it," I chided myself. "You're a grown woman. You can certainly manage to spend one night on your own."
The truth was, it was the first time I had slept alone at all. Someone else had always been in the house with me, my parents and then later my aunt. And yes, I knew that there were other girls just a door away, but somehow the house seemed empty, as if it were possible that I was the sole occupant. I worried for a moment that this might somehow be true. Perhaps there had been an emergency drill that I had missed. I peered out the window, wondering whether I would see a row of girls there, huddled together in the night air. There was no one. Still, I could not quite manage to convince myself that I was not somehow totally and completely alone within the walls of our clambered house. My ears strained for sounds of the other girls, for anything other than the eerie shrieking the two trees continued to produce. There was nothing. Or was there? At some point in the night I began to feel a presence. My heart stammered, the blood rushed to my face. Where before Lucy had acted as a barrier, a shield, between me and everything else, for nothing would ever happen while she was there, I had reasoned. At that moment I was alone, defenseless. I pushed myself to the edge of the bed so that my back aligned with the cold glass surface of the window. I closed my eyes and held my breath, certain that as I did the sound of breathing continued. "It's not real," I told myself.
although the words did little to comfort, to dispel the feeling that I was being watched, that I was no longer alone in the bedroom. I slept little that night. In novels, the heroines always tossed and turned, exclaiming that they were unable to remain still and pass the night in a peaceful sleep. I did not toss and turn. Instead, I remained entirely still. Rigid, I thought, as if the preservation of my life depended upon the immobility of my body. After several hours of this, I began to sweat from the exertion, passing in and out of sleep quickly enough that I could no longer tell how much time had passed, my body bathed in dampness. I could pass a hand across my chest and feel the wetness clinging to my palm. The terror abated only at the first bit of sun peeking through the curtains. Instead of waiting for the day to start, I swept aside the sheets, as if this movement would somehow hasten the arrival of dawn. I had had enough of night. And yet still I lingered, unsure where to go and what to do without Lucy's presence to guide me, to help mark the time. She was always the first to rise, and I waited until she had retreated to the toilet to do the same. Without her, I stalled, lying, waiting. Sleep-deprived from my night alone, I drifted off, despite my intention to stay awake. Instead, my eyelids began to droop, my breathing becoming slow and heavy. I could feel myself falling asleep, and yet I could do nothing at all to resist its soft, insistent call. I awoke, heart pounding. At first I wasn't sure what had woken me, but then I became aware of her presence. I watched, my eyes still half closed in pretense of sleep, as she lifted her blouse over her head, so that she stood in just her bra and underwear, a garter belt rather than a girdle, holding up her stockings. My aunt had insisted I purchase the latter, despite my protests. "You may be naturally thin now," she had said, "but just wait until you're married and have had a few babies. You'll be happy for it then." I realized that I had never seen Lucy this unclothed before. It seemed strange that after years of living together I had yet to see her without clothes, though I knew I had done much the same to avoid such a situation, changing when she was out of the room or rushing to the bathroom to hastily throw on my outfit for the day. I was struck by the sheer whiteness of her skin. She was pale, I knew that already from her complexion, but there was something different seeing it stretched out along the rest of her body. She seemed to glow, so that I was convinced that even if it were completely dark in the room, I would still be able to find her. I was suddenly conscious of just how naked she was. Both her bra and underwear were white, though not the same shade, and typical of the fashion, plain, with a simple trim of lace on the top, which fitted just below her navel. Her bra also had few adornments, just a single white flower between her breasts. My eyes rested there for a moment, wondering at her generous proportions, ones that seemed ample compared to my own, and how she managed to hide them underneath her clothing. I tore my gaze away and back to her face. "Lucy," I said, sitting up, the word sounding like a whisper, too soft for what I had intended. "Lucy, where is it?" I asked, working to make my voice strong, sturdy. Lucy looked over at me and frowned.
"What?"
I let out a deep breath.
"The bracelet."
"What bracelet?"
she asked, shaking her head.
"My mother's bracelet," I pressed.
She shrugged.
"I'm sure it's here somewhere. I haven't seen it since you last wore it, about a week ago."
The words that I meant to speak, that I had prepared and memorized over the hours since we had last parted, evaporated then, disappearing into a vaporous trail before I could make them concrete. I struggled to understand what was happening. It was as if the past day, our past conversation, had not happened at all. As if... I stopped, shuddered. As if I had only imagined it. I looked up at my roommate, searching for something, anything that could be considered as proof, evidence of what she had done, of what she was still doing. There was nothing. She looked sincere, had sounded sincere, as if she truly didn't understand what it was that I was talking about,
as if she were genuinely worried for me.
I don't believe you.
I was surprised by the vehemence behind my thoughts and worried for one moment that I had spoken them aloud. I shook my head. I held firm, resolute, reminding myself that I knew the truth. She had taken the bracelet, angry at me for Tom, for not spending as much time with her. But then, the idea was too strange, too unsettling. I wondered why I had even thought of it in the first place.
I don't know, I finally said.
They were the only words that I could think of as my brain stuttered and failed to keep up with what was happening, the only truth I could arrive at. I didn't know. Lucy frowned.
Don't worry, Alice.
She gave a brief smile.
We'll look for it together, I promise.
She enveloped me then, a more intimate gesture than the others we had previously shared, and not simply because she was standing in her underwear. For it wasn't my roommate who was exposed, who was laid bare. It was me, and all of my shortcomings, the fragility of my mind silently splayed between us. I did not like to think of it, of that period after my parents' death, but now it seemed to burst forth between us, undeniable, so that there was no other choice but to take it out and look at it once more. I remained frozen, still unsure in that moment what to believe. But then eventually my arms left my side, and I grasped her tightly. Too tightly, I knew, but I was suddenly afraid to let her go, this person who knew each and every one of my secrets and had never judged me. And so I clung to her, afraid to break from our strange embrace.
Chapter 6 Lucy. I met Yusuf at Cafe Tingis several days later, at the agreed-upon time. He stood, leaning against the wall.
Ready?
He asked with a grin. I smiled in return, ready to set out, to toss aside the words and warnings of others. For there was something about Yusuf, I had decided, that felt infinitely more familiar than the Johns of the world. We were, both of us, on the outside, the periphery. Myself by birth, Yusuf by circumstance. There was something, if not quite as strong as the affinity I shared with Alice, at the very least an understanding, which I felt ran between us. I was still wary, of course, still cautious, but I trusted the otherness that marked us to form a connective thread that would keep us tied to one another, in spite of, or perhaps because of, the world around us. We left the Medina behind, the confined and chaotic streets giving way to long, wide stretches. Fewer people dotted the path. We walked in a companionable silence, and though I was content to let my mind wander, I found myself turning to him and asking, "So, is it Yusuf or Joseph?" I had been thinking about it in the hour since we had last met, ruminating over the difference. Joseph, Yusuf, were they the same, only derivations of one another? I wasn't sure. In fact, I was no longer entirely certain which one he had first introduced himself as, and which one Alice had used when referring to him. In my mind, he was already Yusuf, but that was possibly my projection alone, trying to instill upon him a particular brand of foreignness that appealed to my own sensibilities. He shrugged. He had lit a cigarette as we began walking, and he reached for it now, taking a long pull. His calloused, darkened fingers apparently untroubled by the still hot ash that spilled over them.
Does it matter?
I frowned. Did it? I found I was no longer sure as I turned the question over in my mind. It's your name, I protested.
We, all of us, have many names,
he responded. I squinted. How do you mean?
Husband, father. Brother.
Those are titles, not names, I countered. He shrugged again, apparently unconcerned with the distinction.
Tangier has many names. First, she was Tingis.
He paused and reached again for his cigarette.
In French, she is Tanger. In Spanish, she is Tanger. In Arabic, she is Tangent. So, you see, she has had many different names, or titles. It is all the same.
I was quiet a moment more. And so you go by either Yosef or Joseph without any preference one way or another? Like her, I mean. He smiled at this.
Yes, like her.
I moved toward the cliff's edge, looking down below. There were a few other couples scattered here and there, to either side of us. Some sat, staring out at the ocean. Others unwrapped bundles of food. I saw bread and cheese, a few pieces of fruit. There were women in niqabs, women in Western dress. It seemed that this was a place for both locals and outsiders alike, although where here was, I had yet to learn. I turned toward my companion, waiting for an explanation.
"This," he began at last, "is where the Mediterranean meets the Atlantic."
"Another layering," I observed ruefully.
"Yes, Alice."
Again he smiled as if he were pleased, as if my answer had satisfied him, and I had passed a test to which only he held the questions and answers.
"It is a layering of history."
He pointed to his feet, and I shifted my gaze to take in the white formation below us.
"These are tombs, Phoenician, from the ancient city of Tingis."
I knew Tangier had been repetitively conquered throughout its existence, so it was always absorbing culture after culture until it had become an accumulation of everyone and everything that had passed through its gates over the centuries. I wondered whether anyone could still trace their lineage from this moment back to the very start without discovering at least one interruption, one interference from the outside world. I looked at my companion and wondered whether he had ever tried, wondered what his blood, what his heart would say if it murmured as mine did, whether his words would also be indecipherable, or whether the message would be clearer, stronger, succeeding where I had failed.
"Come," Yosef called. "The cafe is just this way."
We moved on to a narrow pathway, one that was quickly ensconced by gleaming white walls set on either side of us. There was something different about life set high above the Medina. Quieter, cleaner, perhaps, somehow apart from the frenzy that marked the streets below. It seemed only natural that this quiet, this stillness should be reflected in the very stone. I placed my hand out. It was cool to the touch. And I let my fingers graze over its surface as we walked, my hand trailing languidly at my side. Soon the entrance appeared before us, the title formed by a grouping of rocks affixed to the white wall. Cafe Haffa Fonda, 1921. I reached out and swept my hand over the now smooth pebbles, just a slightly darker shade than the stark white walls they were placed upon, wondering how many other hands had done the same in the years since they were first set there. I thought I could feel it then. History. Heavy and weighted, as if the knowledge that the great writers and painters and musicians who had similarly passed through this entryway provided a gravity missing from every other place before it. Tangier, I decided then, was a ghost town in many ways. Only instead of being dead, empty, barren, it was alive. It was thriving and bursting with the remembrance of those great minds who had walked its alleyways, who had thought and sipped tea and been inspired here. It was a testimony, a tomb to those who had come before. But there was not a sense that it was over, done with. There was something still here, churning, thriving, waiting to be discovered or released. I could feel it, tingling in my hands. I wondered if Alice felt it as well. In the days since my arrival, I had already found myself thinking that it was as if I had been waiting for Tangier my entire life. As if everything that I had done, every thought and action had brought me here, specifically for the purpose of finding her once more, and the life we could have. It was perfect. I wanted to tell her, desperately wanting her to see it as well, how wonderfully perfect it all was. Tangier, her, the two of us together in this foreign city. I turned the corner, my eyes quickly taking in the terrace-style seating that faced the ocean, the blue of the water offset by the dazzling white of the tea house. "It's beautiful," I whispered, conscious of the words even before I uttered them. Yusuf did not seem to hear. Instead, he moved slowly down the terraces one by one until selecting the very last.
"So you can lean over and look out,"
he said, settling into a chair. I nodded, knowing the moment had come, for I had another reason for agreeing to meet with him, something more important, more urgent than sightseeing, the knowledge of what Yusuf had to offer now beating steadily within my chest. I sat next to him, trying to stop myself from imagining what he might be able to give me, a magic key, a secret incantation, something, anything that was more definitive, more concrete than a glimpse caught in the reflection of a mirror. I removed a photograph from my purse and placed it onto the table. "There is an Englishman," I said. But then before I could continue, a young boy appeared, asking for our order. "Tea, please," I replied, and turning to Yusuf, assured him, "It's my treat." Money was an issue we had not broached before, but the look in his eyes as I glanced toward him warned me never to make the same offer again. I shifted in my seat, remaining silent, waiting. Although the words I wished to speak, the questions I wanted to ask, about John, about the local woman I had seen him with, burned, begging to be released. I could see that Yusuf would have to set the tone, the pace of the conversation after the misstep I had just taken.
"This is him?"
he asked after a few minutes of silence had elapsed, the tea delivered. He did not move to pick up the photograph, only let his fingers, clenched around a cigarette, linger above it. I worried for a moment that the ash would fall and leave a burn mark. I had removed the photograph earlier that morning from one of the frames in Alice's sitting room, my fingers working quietly, afraid that Alice would walk in and find me stealing a photograph of her husband. If caught, I hadn't a clue as to what I would say. I flinched now, watching as the ash from Yusuf's cigarette grew, forming a leaning tower that burned white and hot. If it fell, there would be no way to explain its presence. Alice would know. I breathed a quick sigh of relief when Yusuf moved his hand away, the ash tumbling to the ground. "Yes." I hesitated, still waiting. In my mind, Yusuf seemed to exist on some border, halfway between official and unofficial, between light and dark. In my imagining of how this conversation would proceed, I had assumed he would direct the ebb and flow of our words, that he would know how and where this was supposed to move. "There is also a woman," I said, casting a quick, hurried glance in his direction. His eyebrows raised.
"Not his wife, I presume."
I shook my head. "No. But I wonder..." He looked over at me.
"What do you wonder, Alice?"
I held his gaze. "Who she is?"
"Will it help?"
he asked, tilting his head to the side.
"To know this answer."
I nodded, trying not to betray my eagerness. "Yes, I think so." He paused and then said,
"She is French."
He tilted his head, apparently reconsidering his previous statement.
"Well, half. Half this, half Moroccan."
He gave a short laugh.
"Not so uncommon as one might suppose."
I was about to sip my tea, but at his words I stopped.
"You know her?"
I asked, surprised. "And do you know him?" I pointed to the photograph. I had figured that after our conversation, Yusuf might ask around, perhaps look into the matter himself. I had not considered that he might already possess the answers. He shrugged.
Do you want to know?
Yes, I said eagerly, adding please only as an afterthought. He paused, as if he did not wish to continue, as if to emphasize that he was only doing so as a favor to me, and I wondered then what he would ask for in return, for I was certain that he would, that nothing he did was ever done without consideration of what could be gained. There was, I knew, a difference in refusing charity and giving something away for free.
She's a French woman, an artist. That is how I know her.
He paused.
She also works at a nightclub.
I let the word settle. A nightclub. We both knew what he actually meant. Despite the pretense, the nightclubs in the city were little more than a gathering place for prostitutes, geared toward Westerners. They were scattered throughout Tangier, most of them run by French women who had decided to leave behind a life of selling their own bodies in order to sell another's. And her name? I pressed.
Sabine.
He turned to look at me.
Her name is Sabine.
I leaned forward, all pretense at disinterest gone. At this information, at the power it provided me, my ears began to roar, my hands shake. I had not thought it would be this easy, and up until that moment, I had not wanted to admit to myself just how much I needed the answers. And how long has this been going on? Between them, I mean? He looked as though the question did not interest him. Instead, he shifted in his seat, tossing his cigarette to the ground, and said lazily,
I would advise you not to be that girl.
At the word, I felt myself retreat, and though I could not explain my reaction, the sound and shape of it, the implication behind his use set my heart racing. I silently chastised myself. It was only a word. After all, it did not mean anything. But no, I knew that was not true. It did mean something. Everything. What girl? I demanded. He looked at me pointedly.
That girl.
He was not talking about me, of course. I knew that he had wrongly assumed that it was my husband in the picture, and since I was supposed to be Alice in that moment, I supposed it technically was, and yet, though his words were not aimed at me, I was livid, angry at him on behalf of Alice, and angry at something else, something I couldn't quite define. I grabbed my purse and began to walk away. It was only several minutes later when I realized he had not shouted for me to come back, had not chased after me in order to apologize. No matter. I continued walking, out of Café Haffa, back to the spot above the tombs. If Yusuf would not help, I decided that I would find a way on my own. I paused, looking out at the blue merging of the Atlantic and Mediterranean, and I wondered if there was a word for it. A name, a title to indicate this strange layering that seemed to be commonplace in Tangier, where everything was something else first, and nothing was ever entirely one thing. I thought of Alice again. She was something else in Tangier, too. Something completely different. Hardened. Distant. Tired. A new Alice had been layered upon an old one, subsuming the original. But I had not given up hope. She was not simply Alice, John's wife. She had been her own person once. She had existed without him. What I needed to discover was how to get her back, how to move from Tangier to Tingis, and whether such a Herculean feat was even possible. I had been walking in the Place de la Casbah, alongside the fortified walls, stopping every now and then to scribble something in my notebook, trying to shake off my strange conversation with Yusuf. I stopped at Bab Bar, one of the gates that opened, and broke up the monotony of the stone, so that there was nothing before me but the sea and the sky. Yusuf had told me a story about the place, though I struggled under the heat of the sun to recall the exact words. Something about a beautiful female spirit who supposedly haunted the area, tempting men to their fate. I smiled at the idea. And it was then that I saw him. I was standing just outside the Bob, hidden from his line of vision. At first I thought he was alone, but then I saw him pull the woman beside him toward the wall. The same woman from the bar, I quickly realized, and my breath caught in my throat. I noted first the confidence in the way the woman held herself, so unlike Alice. Shoulders back, chest out, her body accentuated by the dress she was wearing, despite the loose shape of it. Her hair was piled on top of her head, her arms weighed down with heavy bracelets, both silver and gold, which clinked together as she moved. I could see under the light of the day that she was most precisely as Yosef had described, a little Moroccan, a little French, the combination resulting in something that arrested one's attention, that seemed to clamor and fight for it, in fact. Her skin was golden, her eyes dark. I thought about John's love of Tangier and decided it all made sense, that his lust should find itself manifested in this creature, this woman who placed her foreignness on display in a way that was suited, designed to attract a foreigner's eye. I pitied the girl, for that was, I could now see as well all that she was. No more than 17 years old, I guessed. Moving closer behind my hiding space, feeling the hot bite of the wall behind me, I watched as John's fingers, his hands freckled and sun-kissed, splayed themselves across her tiny waist, his desire so evident, so easy. I stood, mesmerized by his hands, by their quick, insistent movements under the hot, unforgiving sun. My face burned, though not from the heat of the day, and ashamed then at the ache I felt watching them together, I moved quickly to turn away. Later, I would wonder at the calmness of my reaction, for I supposed that I should have felt something like outrage upon seeing John there, his betrayal displayed so brazenly under the hot, brilliant sun of Morocco. He must have reasoned that Alice would never find out, as she rarely left the apartment and knew no one else in the city. He had, it seemed, decided to take full advantage of that fact. But now, she had me. It was something that must have occurred to him as well when he turned and saw me standing there, underneath the arch. His face visibly paled beneath his tan, and he started toward me, his arm still wrapped around the woman. Entangled, I thought, and not in any way that could be explained away, particularly not if I had witnessed what had come before. I could see him thinking, calculating, wondering how long I had been there and just how much I had seen. At last, his hands dropped away and he started toward me. But I was quicker. I moved from my perch into the crowd, tourists crowding the Bob for a perfect photo, locals trailing behind, trying desperately to unload their jewelry, their hats, whatever piece of merchandise was on sale. It was easy to become lost, to let myself be swept up in the tide. I surrendered to its chaos, to the ebb and flow that grasped me in its clutches and refused to release me. I let it carry me farther and farther away until I felt brave enough to glance over my shoulder. I could barely make out his person. He was simply a small speck of color against a brightly decorated canvas. My face was flushed from the exertion of my escape, my breath coming in small, sharp gasps. I wondered then whether John would confront me, whether I would return to the flat only to find him waiting, demanding to know what I had seen and whether or not I would tell Alice. A part of me hoped that he would, that his figure would be the one to greet me. I could feel the promise of it rush through me, could feel my fingers begin to tingle, my toes curl in anticipation. Walking back to my apartment, for I could no longer imagine pursuing my earlier wanderings, I noticed that I had managed to drop my notebook somewhere during my escape. And yet the realization seemed dulled somehow, far away and altogether foreign, as if it, what I had been doing earlier, could not possibly belong to the person I was in that moment. A person who burned and raged and did not wish to be silent. I headed for the flat, walking for what seemed like hours, though it could not have been more than a handful of minutes. I watched as the shadows around me began to lengthen, felt the heat of the day begin to dissipate. My heartbeat began to slow. My breath returned to normal. By the time I reached the Quartier du Marchand, the emotions that had earlier coursed through me seemed to evaporate, leaking out of my skin, my pores, until there was nothing left but pure and utter exhaustion. I let out a small sigh and continued inside.
Chapter 7 Alice.
It's so hot. Lucy paused at my words, waiting for me to catch my breath as we made our way to Café Haffa. The day was too thick, the sun too hot, but she had been determined earlier that morning that I accompany her to the café. I could feel my face already red and sticky with sweat.
I can't believe you've never been, she said, trying, I suspected, to distract me from the heat, though the comment only sat poorly with me.
I could feel my face grow more crimson still, my breathing ragged. I placed one foot in front of the other, the sun burning the back of my neck, warming the top of my head, so that I looked with envy at the turban which Lucy had wrapped her own hair underneath that morning. She had traded, it seemed, her usual hat, an awful design made of black straw, for a pale wrap she had no doubt found in one of the shops frequented by expats. Earlier I had stared rather hard at the sight of it, just as we were leaving. It's the fashion now, she had assured me, though I had continued to watch her with unease. It was not the design itself that had stopped me, but rather the realization of just how well Lucy blended in with the rest of the expatriates that flooded the streets of Tangier. I had been here for months already, while her feet had barely touched soil for a week, and already it looked as though she was the one who lived here, as though I was only the visitor. It was with embarrassment that I had then reached for my own hat, a rather small white pillbox that fit oddly on top of my hair.
"It's supposed to have breathtaking views," Lucy said.
I peered at her, curious.
"How did you hear about it?"
"Some friends at the bookshop, the Librairie des Colonnes," she replied. I nodded, wondering when she had managed to sneak in a visit there as well.
"You sound almost like a local now," I said, my voice, I knew, tinged with something that made me uneasy.
After that day when she had first told me about Yusuf, she had continued to return to the flat late each night, ready to regale me with further tales of her adventures, and I had listened with the same envy, the little knot growing into something large and not so easily managed. Instead, I had tried to reshape it, had tried to see Tangier through her eyes, her enthusiasm, similar to John's, describing a world I could never manage to catch a glimpse of, though all three of us walked upon the same cobblestones. And so when she had demanded, at the end of her first week, that I accompany her, I agreed, anxious to discover what it was that I had been missing, that my eyes refused to see.
"You should come with me next time," she offered now, "to the bookstore."
I did not respond. We walked for a few more minutes in silence until at last we came to stand upon a strange white surface, just a few feet, I could see, from the edge of a cliff.
"It's beautiful, isn't it?"
she ventured, looking over at me. She waited for a reply so that I could feel her reaching out. "It is, of course it is," I wanted to say, but something stopped the words. Something stilled me. There were still too many questions and answers obscured by the fog, but which shone, nevertheless, red and bright and warning. "It's bluer than anything at home," I conceded, continuing to stare out at the ocean, working to make my face unreadable.
"There are tombs just below us," she continued.
We stood close together, staring at the rectangular formations, at the strange dips and curves and the puddles of water that pocketed the white rock.
"Where? Directly below us?"
She nodded.
"The tombs are nearly 2,000 years old, from when the city was called Tingis."
"Tingis?"
I asked with a small smile.
"That was the name of the ancient Phoenician city, before Tangier ever existed."
She removed her sunglasses, squinting against the sun.
Tangier has had a lot of different names, apparently. Tingis is only one of them.
What were the others? I asked, feeling my voice become lazy under the heat of the sun.
There's Tingis, of course. Tingi, Titgam, Tangier, Tangiers, Tangier. I guess it depends who you ask and how they pronounce it.
I turned to her. How do you pronounce it? She liked the question, I could see, that it mattered to her what I thought. She seemed to consider for a moment, as if weighing the answer.
I suppose I'll always say Tangier, but I like the idea of Tingis, of what it was originally, before it was changed by all the various invaders.
There is a sort of romance, I admitted.
It's a country steeped in mythology, she replied. Do you know it's thought that even Ulysses must have passed Tangier during his travels?
She looked so proud, standing on top of the Phoenician tombs, as if she had made the discovery herself. I tried to picture it, Lucy as some great explorer or conqueror, and I found the idea suited her. Her excitement was so palpable that I could almost feel it, transferring from her body into my own. The heat pulsed around us, the sun pressing down, and yet still, as we moved away from the view, I could sense that we were both reluctant to leave it behind. It was calm here, as if some sort of magic spell divided it from the rest of the city. While down below there was shouting and bartering, the scent of thousands of perspiring bodies pressed up against one another, dirty and unwavering, up here there was only silence, only the warm, inviting blue that stretched out and rushed into the currents of the Atlantic, only the smell of the ocean, clean and fresh. I might have imagined it, but I felt as though our feet dragged as we turned away, as we began to close the short distance between us and the cafe. We sat on one of the lower terraces, under a few scraggly trees. The relief was immediate, and I could breathe again. Up until that moment, I had not realized just how warm I had become, standing in the open field before the ocean, without a single tree for protection. At our entrance, one of the workers ran over, balancing a swinging contraption that allowed him to carry several glasses of tea at once, its metallic coating glinting off the bright sun. Lucy ordered two, and thanked him. Shukran. I mused briefly over the fact that thank you and no thank you were so closely related, the difference of a word added to the latter. It was, I realized, the type of inane observation that Lucy would probably enjoy. I closed my eyes and sighed. Wasps swarmed the blossoms on the trees above, but for the most part ignored us, even our tall glasses of sugary hot tea. It should have been peaceful, I should have felt relaxed, but anxiety gnawed at me, refusing to be ignored. Her arrival had set something in motion. I could feel it already, churning, refusing to remain dormant. And yet I could feel us both stalled, waiting for that something to happen, as if we had been waiting for it ever since that day she had stepped off the boat. I had the sudden, irresistible urge to set it in motion then, to push us together over the cliff, to ask her everything that I had been wondering, puzzling over, ever since she had arrived in Tangier, ever since I had first met her at Bennington. All the things that eluded me, slipping through my fingers, the strange wisps of a girl I seemed to have conjured out of my misery, but who had never seemed to materialize into something real, something concrete. I was angry, the heat turning my mood. I could feel it, simmering around me, those things that I did not understand, the places and people that remained a mystery to me, that refused to yield no matter how often I puzzled over them. Tangier and Lucy were the same, I thought, both unsolvable riddles that refused to leave me in peace. And I had tired of it, of the not knowing, of always feeling as though I were on the outside of things, just on the periphery.
"Are you all right, Alice?" Lucy asked. "I'm fine," I replied, though I knew there was an unmistakable edge to my voice as I pushed my sunglasses farther up the bridge of my nose. They had begun to slip from the sweat. I sipped my tea and then thrust it away in frustration. I was silent for a time, And then, only when I was certain that she did not intend to break the silence herself, I began, my eyes squinting in the sun. "I'll never understand it." Lucy turned.